Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and Jeff. McClure. All of our training that people hear us bragging about for so long on how our practice on saying our names, and this is an example of how no matter how hard you practice, sometimes we can't say our own names. It often occurs when I'm adjusting sound balances and so on at the same time, but it's kind of like chewing bubblegum and walking. You would expect people to be able to say their own names while doing other things. So I'm just saying we may not be fully well-rounded in our name chanting ceremony.
So you think we're squared?
Yeah, we've got a couple of sharp edges, or three. Okay. Or four.
All right.
Yeah. This is The Personal Wealth Coach, as we've just said. Before we get started in talking to you about wealth coaching and economics and the world in general, we have a bunch of disclosures that we're going to say ad nauseum, and we'll try to do it in a way that is as different from other disclosures that you will see here or read. Can you smell a disclosure? I guess if it's too close to you. We're going to try to do it in a different way. We are The Personal Wealth Coach, which is the name of both this radio program, podcast, and a firm registered with the SEC to give fiduciary investment advice. Boy, is that confusing or what? I was telling you, it's hard to say our own names, and now we've got the same name applied to three different things. Wait a minute. The SEC registered investment advisory firm and the principals of it are the same people that are the hosts of this radio program and the podcast. The radio program held the name before the SEC registered firm. But just because the firm is registered to give SEC registered, how many times can I say registered in that? Investment advice doesn't mean we can do it on the air. In fact, it means we can't do it on the air because we don't know everybody listening. Presumably, that's a big presumption, isn't it? We might. There might not be anyone listening. Then we can give fiduciary investment advice to no one and charge for it. Wouldn't that be great? But we can't do that on the radio. There's privacy concerns. Obviously, we don't know everybody we're talking to. We don't know your specific circumstances, all that good stuff. And just because the firm's registered with the SEC does not mean that the SEC has some kind of a favorite child position for us. We are not even the redheaded child. We have no hair. So they are simply the regulatory institution to which we are beholden as we give advice. So we're not going to be giving advice on the air. If we're not giving advice, what are we doing? We said we're coaching. What is that? If not, well, we're giving education. We're giving you some things that don't have to do with your specific location and circumstances, but rather how to read the map rather than how to get to a specific destination. Educational. Let's see what else. Said it's educational. I said, we don't pay for this program. This is not paid commercial advertising. We also don't get paid for this program. We've been giving up our Saturday mornings for a quarter of a century plus to blather on the radio to a slowly shrinking audience base on AM radio and a slowly increasing audio base on the digital spectrums. What does that mean? Why? Or am I saying that? Because a lot of times when you turn on the radio or you pull up a podcast, it is an advertisement for a business. While we do get business because we do this program, that is not the purpose of the program. The purpose of the program is to educate a bunch of people that don't know nothing about nothing, including us. Our lack of knowledge is far larger than our knowledge, and we're doing our darned hardest, may not be our best, but we're trying to edumacate everybody when it comes to finance and economics. It's tilting at windmills. The Giants seem to keep winning, and the Miller seems to be really upset. But you've got a final disclosure for us. And if that sounded like a normal disclosure, what I just said, then I have totally failed.
Well, I don't think you failed.
This part will sound like a normal disclaimer, though, so this is good.
I don't know. I'm not going to say it very fast, so it's really not a normal.
You have
disclaimer.
To lower the volume and speak as fast as you possibly can.
Not going to do it. Not
but
going
if
to
you
do
slowed it down, it would sound like this.
The information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Though we do guarantee the incompleteness of unsaid and unread information. There. Now, now that we have fully disclosed, disclaimed, and disinterested everyone, please continue with what happened in the market this week.
Well, the S&P 500 saw it up and down, and we use the S&P 500 stock index, otherwise affectionately known as the SPX. It jumped up and down during the week, got excited, got depressed, got excited, got depressed. And like a lot of other weeks, particularly this year, it wound up just a little bit higher, 0.39%. 0.4% effectively higher than it started the week. Now, we've had a lot of weeks like that, but if you take 52 weeks and you look at a 0.4% rise, you have a pretty good year. And we've had a pretty good year already. You know, we're now about 12% higher than where we began the year in the S&P 500. The important line that was crossed, at least psychologically, this week is the S&P 500 wound up just over 20% higher than it was on October 12th. And there's a tradition among people who watch investments and in indices and things like that, that when the market is down, when the S&P 500 is down 20%, we start a bear market. And when it is up 20% from a bottom, we start a bull market. Now, that's totally beside the point. If you invested in January of 2022, because you're still 10% below where you were in January of 2022, but the consensus, or at least the pundit consensus, is that we're now in a new bull market. Actually, there's a couple of ways that we measure bull markets that I think make sense. One is from the bottom.
Right.
So the bull market started October 12th, but looking you have to look back to see that. What?
Was it October 12th or 22nd?
It was the 12th.
Okay.
At least I think it was. And, you know, another way of looking at a bull market, in some ways, the bear market continues from the top of the market through the next time it breaks through wherever it was last time. But we're up 20% from the bottom, and so that's a good thing. It didn't seem to have a lot of psychological effect, because the wall of worry that bull markets traditionally climb is definitely in place. There's still a lot of people who firmly believe we're headed for a downturn. As a matter of fact, the short interest, you want to say something?
Yeah, well, there's a little metric here that this is the longest running, under the way that we've just talked about measuring bear and bulls, which, just as a side note, we've talked about this sort of thing in the past. Bear markets and bull markets do not have an official definition. There's sort of definitions, but if you read them in Investopedia and Wikipedia and several other sources, you'll find you get as many opinions on it as you have sources on it. So the sort of consensus is a 20% drop is a bear, a 10% drop is a correction, and then the bull market is any time it's risen more than 20% from the bottom. But that leaves a question. During the time from October to today, we were in a bull market, but it wasn't officially a bull market until now, so it was just a market. Now it's official that it was a bull market then, so that we can retroactively say it wasn't just a market, it was a bull. Definitions are silly. There's no good one.
But I'm glad you understand that.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. The metric I was going to throw out there is that under that definition, this is the longest bear market we have had since 1940. There.
Really?
Yeah. Look it up. It was in the Wall Street Journal.
Wait a minute. In the year 2000, in October, the market started down and it didn't hit bottom until 2002.
Oh,
almost 2 years later.
Uh-huh.
So it was going down the entire time period.
Yeah, but the bear market started at the 20% mark, not at the top.
Oh,
so this is where the definitions get stupid again. So it's great. We can say that we have broken a record not seen since 1940, or we can say, wait a minute, there's lots of bear market. Wait, I will give you another record to break. In the history of the world, there has never been a June 10th, 2023 like this one. There you go. We have broken another record. Now back to the market.
I'm glad that you have this critical information in your brain.
It's breaking news.
What we have is an indicator, and that is that markets at some point will be higher in the future. And the indicator is based on the fact that we have the most short interest on the S&P 500 that we have seen in a long time. Well, since 2006.
And short interest is when somebody has borrowed a stock and sold it and thus therefore has to buy it back to return the loan. There's a lot of people doing it right now.
And the issue with short interest, and a lot of it is uncovered short interest. Uncovered short interest, called naked shorts, is when a person borrows a stock, sells it, but doesn't currently own a share of that stock that they can give back, which means they have to buy a share of that stock to give it back. So there's the more short interest there is out there, the more short sales there are, the more stock there is that has to be bought back. When they buy that stock back, that drives the price of the stock up. So now that doesn't necessarily mean we're about to launch into a bull market, but it does mean that it's...
Are we in a bull market?
We are in a bull market. It doesn't mean we're running runaway bull market that will shoot up forever. All I'm saying is there's a lot of short interest out there, which along with the other evidence, the negative sentiment in the market. Now, unlike 2006 and 2007, when we had a lot of short interest, there in 2006 and 7, most of the people who were going to buy into the market had already bought, and we had very little money sitting on the sidelines that had come out of stocks and was not going anywhere. It wasn't being put into bonds. It wasn't being put into real estate. We had very little money sitting there to further fuel a bull market. As a matter of fact, a lot of it was in real estate, but it went in real estate earlier on. And real estate's what took the market down. So what we have is something approaching a record percentage of money that is what we call tagged money. In other words, money that's come out of stocks and is sitting on the sideline and pretty clearly is intended to go back in to buy stocks at some point. Now, the end of a bull market very consistently is when the money that is intended to buy stocks, in other words, it came out of stocks at some point, and when people are surveyed, they say, that's money I'm waiting for the market to go down to buy in, is at record lows. That is the end of a major bull market. When we have those numbers at record highs, it normally is the very early stages in a bull market or the end of a bear market. So there's a lot of indicators out there, technical indicators, that suggest that there's a lot of room for the market to go up. On the other hand, there are some other indicators out there, like the fact that there's only a few major tech stocks that are driving the S&P 500 up, and the smaller stocks, not the smallest, the smallest stocks, contained normally in the Russell 2000, have done very poorly recently. There's a lot of indicators. Now, we follow a mid-cap value index, the CRSP mid-cap value index, which also is up about 10% this year. And that suggests to me that the spread in the rise in the market is a little wider than some of the news media are saying. So there's a lot of conflicting, just like in the economy right now, there's a lot of conflicting information about whether we're in a bull or a bear market. I tend to be optimistic going forward. But then again, I tend to be optimistic. And there's a reason I'm optimistic. When I started in this business, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was climbing through 1,000 for the third time. And the consensus was that it surely had to go back down because it always went back down when it climbed above 1,000. It's a little higher than that today. And it's a lot higher than that today. And had you invested at the top of the bull market at 1,000 back in 1982 or 1983, you would have done really well along the way. Anyway, so what we've got is a pretty good growth in the market going on. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note did nothing, but it did it with a great deal of enthusiasm. It's at 3.75%. That's the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is a lot higher than it was a couple of years ago, obviously. And I think it's likely to stay there. And the further maturities further out are gradually climbing. So when the yield curve gets back to its normal non-inverted position, if it ever does, I think what we'll have is the 10-year treasury staying about where it is, and the longer dated treasuries, the 20 and 30 year, rising. And eventually, Lord willing, we will get back to the situation where short-term treasuries are at a lower position. But right now, everything below 1 year, every 1 year and below maturities are of an annualized rate of over 5%. As a matter of fact, the two-year note is yielding 4.59%. In other words, if you bought a two-year treasury right now, it'd be 4.59%. If you bought a four-month treasury, it's about 5.4% annualized. So short-term rates are very, very high right now. Price of oil slipped down to $70.37 per barrel, West Texas Intermediate. By the way, West Texas Intermediate is now a component of Brent crude, which is the global standard. So Brent crude oil, which used to be the global standard while West Texas Intermediate was a U.S. standard, now includes the West Texas Intermediate as part of the calculation. And that is a recognition of the fact that we are one of the major global oil suppliers right now. As a matter of fact, on some months, the United States is the biggest supplier of oil to the world, which is certainly a big change from the past. And that's the markets.
Thank you. Well done. We have a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. The very first one, as is tradition, is from Inquisitor John, who traditionally asks us questions. And the questions that he asks this time have to do with the treasury market, the U.S. debt market, the debt of the United States government. And his question subject is treasury buyers, and he's got a picture of an article from the Wall Street Journal, the paper version. There's a digital picture. It's titled, Big Influx of T-Bills Threatens Volatility. And he dives into a very specific question in the article. The article is talking about the calamity that we avoided. The debt ceiling was raised. But in the process of getting to that debt ceiling raise, we went about 6 months, so about five full months, of not being able to borrow money at the United States government. Which means that they went and they found every penny they could find that already existed in their coffers, and they scooped it out and they spent it. So all of the accounts are empty. There's some mothballs and some cobwebs in a couple of them, but the rest of them have nothing. They are thoroughly swept out. The vacuum cleaner that was used to suck them out got all the dust bunnies. We got to fill those back up. A lot of the accounts that were drained to pay for other things were things that we've said we're going to do, like road projects and contract money to large defense contractors. Things like that that were either put on hold, or the balance of the money, which is coming out in monthly increments, there's not enough money in there to pay the next one. So where do we get the money? Well, we've been using the revenue. Revenue's been coming in, and we went through April, which is the big month for revenue for the U.S. government. People pay a lot of taxes in April, and so you get this big bulge in our budget of non-borrowing because we got all this other money coming in. Now we got to borrow, and we got to borrow a lot, like $1 trillion. Yes, that's with a T, $1 trillion. That is a lot of zeros. Just count them. There's 9 zeros in a billion. There are 12 zeros we're talking about here that has to be borrowed just to get back to even. And when that occurs, that causes interest rates to go up. If everybody wants to borrow money to buy a house at the same time, but there's still only as much money available as there was before to loan to houses, that's a supply and demand thing. It means the people that are giving or loaning the money can charge a higher interest rate. And the article in the Wall Street Journal is talking about that. Hey, the U.S. Treasury might have to borrow at really stupid interest rates because interest rates are already high. And when they borrow at stupid interest rates, it's going to be expensive. So John's question is about one of the facets in that story, that banks aren't doing a lot of that purchasing right now because they are on the hook for a bunch of loans from the Fed to fill up their longer term maturity stuff. And I realize that's a complicated subject. We won't get too deep into it. We've talked about it in the past. Banks are not jumping forward to buy up the treasuries to loan the United States government money right now. Big chunk of that, when SVB failed, it was because they held too much treasuries and a long maturity. To get out of that hole, they had to borrow a bunch of money from the Federal Reserve, and it's got a higher interest rate than what they're earning. So they've got problems there. So the banks aren't there to buy up all this new debt that the government's about to release. And the article says, well, the money market positions are stepping in to those roles now, and they're buying up that debt. They're loaning the government money. And the direct quote that he's got circled, that would be a best case scenario. According to strategists, money market funds could step up as the primary financiers of this round of bond issues. And his question, which is a very, very deeply faceted question in that larger subject, it's already a complicated subject. He says, what are the impacts of banks versus money market funds buying all these treasuries? And you've got your hand raised.
I've got an answer.
Oh, I've got an answer. It's probably not right. The answer is 42.
Okay.
Sorry. No, back to you.
Well, there have been several articles recently about the fact that there have been insufficient short-term treasuries being offered by the Treasury for the rush of money into money market funds. So the money market funds have been turning to the Federal Reserve, to the repo market in the Federal Reserve, actually a reverse repo market, which is really weird, to get the interest rates that they're paying, because there's this flood of money that's been going into money market funds, by the way, out of banks into money market funds, because they're offering a higher interest rate. Short-term interest rates are high. Presuming that you're correct, and I think you probably are, that this rush of new borrowing from the Treasury will continue to raise short-term interest rates, there will probably be a greater rush of money into money market funds. And I think the money market funds are not going to have any trouble soaking up the additional borrowing that the Treasury wants to do, because there are literally trillions of dollars of money in money market funds right now. And an interesting fact that coming out of the great financial crisis that we had, the great recession, as it was called, money market funds, many of them are now required to borrow only federal, they can only borrow federal obligations unless they disclose that they're not doing that. And they don't have to set aside reserves if they borrow Treasury securities or borrow from the Federal Reserve. I say borrow. They don't borrow from them. They actually loan to the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. So I think the money market funds are going to have no problem at all soaking this up. I think they're going to just gobble it up very, very quickly and very, very efficiently. And I think that the pundits are just worried about something that's probably not going to be a problem.
The long-term implication of this is different, though. Because what that means is that because more money is flowing into money market positions, and the money market positions are offering a higher interest rate generally than most banks. So those are the trends right now. Mm-hmm. That means more money will flow into money market positions. And I'm going to give a weird analogy here, a parallel. We've talked in the past about how when oil prices go up, sometimes it takes a while for it to hit the pump. And when oil prices go down, sometimes it takes a while for it to be at the pump. When you're pumping gas, wait, I know oil prices are down. Why am I still paying more? And that has a lot to do with the gas station that you are frequenting. They have a tank in the ground. And the tank in the ground holds gas that they already purchased, not today's price. They purchased that at some previous price. And gas stations that don't have a lot of customers, they don't, or they have a really big tank, can keep oil prices or gas prices down for longer. But the more they do that, the more people come and use their gas. So they drain through that tank quickly. But they were able to keep the price down. The same thing's true when the price is up. If they have a big tank and they bought it at a high price, it's going to take them longer to lower the price because they bought that inventory at a high price. Now they got to sell it to you at a high price, even though prices are down now. That's happening at the bank right now. The bank is locked into these longer term interest rates that are much lower. And it's taking them a long time to adjust because they have to get to the maturity on all these long-term issues. They have to get through their tank, and their tank is really big. So money is fleeing the banks to go to the money markets. And the money markets had much shorter term maturities in a lot of their products. So their tanks were smaller. If you follow that analogy, it's the same here. Their tanks are smaller. They were able to drop the price faster or raise their interest rate faster. What does that mean long term? Long term, there's less money at the banks. And banks are still the primary place that we get mortgages. If there's less money at the bank, they have to raise interest rates on their mortgages. And what we've been seeing over the past month or so is interest rates on 30-year mortgages have been increasing. So it's going to make it more expensive to get a mortgage because more of the money from the federal government is being loaned by money markets than banks. So that's a extrapolation that is a year away from now and increasing into the future. It will equalize again as things come back to rationality in the interest rate area. That irrationality is coming directly from the Fed and how they're selling bonds on the market and where they're selling it. And we can see that directly on the Fed balance sheet versus the interest rates as we go around. So, I mean, it's all written on the wall. The Fed's the one doing this, but it means that money markets are taking on a much larger role as a depository institution for even much smaller investors than they used to be. And banks, which used to be Main Street, everybody has a bank account. It may get to the point in the next couple of years that everybody just has a money market account and it goes online and they do check writing or debit card doing on their money market position. This could be a massive shift or it could all go back to nothing. How's that?
Well, there's an interesting contrast going on out there about money and it's sticky. Chase, which is a big bank and a lot of people use it.
Otherwise known as JP Morgan Chase.
Yes, but this is called Chase Bank.
Right. It's a subset of JP Morgan Chase.
In its savings is offering 0.01% interest.
Woohoo!
Bank of America, 0.01% interest. Wells Fargo, 0.15% interest. But if you start looking for other banks, there's a lot of them that are offering 4.85% interest right now. And people are not moving their money from the very low interest positions to the higher interest positions for reasons that have a lot to do with stickiness and convenience. For instance, we have a bank that we use that's paying a very low interest rate. And we have a series of accounts there, and we have a loyal long-term relationship with that bank, and it would be a real pain to move our money someplace to get a higher interest rate on it. So there's this tendency of people to leave their money at low interest rates in banks that is playing out big. As a matter of fact, over the last couple of weeks, instead of deposits fleeing the banks, banks, particularly small to intermediate sized banks, which there was a lot of concern about recently, are seeing deposits increasing, more money coming into the banks. People are still in the position where when they put money in the bank, they're more secure. It's kind of like Will Rogers said, people are more concerned about the return of their money than they are return on their money. And I think for some reason or another, people are definitely keeping their money in low interest positions in banks. Now, if inflation continues to be serious, eventually people will start moving their money. But for right now, the banks are flush with money and there's more money coming in. And that was one of the concerns we had a couple of weeks ago when Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, among others, failed. Is people were pulling their money out and putting it someplace else. But it's stabilized very nicely. And I would say that I don't understand why people leave their money at 0.01% when they could be earning 4.85%, except for the fact that we're doing it too. And it's a real administrative pain to move your money from a low interest position at a bank to a higher interest position. The thing you want from the bank is that, you know, we've got debit cards at that bank. We've got checking accounts at that bank. It's a real pain to move money around.
And on that,
people don't do it.
And on that note, bank deposits prior to the pandemic, this is commercial bank deposits. So what that means is what you would think of as a bank deposit. We're not talking about CDs. We're not talking about money market positions. This is just money you have in your bank accounts gathered all together across the United States. Prior to the pandemic, February 5th, there was about $13.3 trillion. This is all Federal Reserve data. And you can tell we're nerds because we know Fred. Fred is the economic data portal from the St. Louis Federal Reserve. And so $13.3 trillion prior to the pandemic. At the top of the pandemic, in just in banks again, not CDs, not the other stuff, not money markets, $18 trillion was sitting in there. So there's a difference of $5 trillion. A bunch of that was stimulus. Some of it was people just cutting way, 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 way back on other things. So there's a combination of lots and lots and lots of stuff that caused us to hang on to money more. We were scared. And that was right around April of 2022. So it was a little over a year ago. We're now sitting at about $17.3 trillion. So we're still $4 trillion up from what we were then. And when you calculate inflation, that's still way above the inflation growth during that time period. We have more in savings today, even calculating for inflation, by a lot than we did prior to the pandemic. And this is part of the reason why we're not in a recession right now. We've been able to spend money, and we were spending really fast heading into March, and we're kind of slowing down now. And so our deposits are rising in the different institutions. So there's kind of interesting pictures there in a very boring and nerdy way for those of you that want to go to some barbecue and talk about Fred and how many cash deposits we had before and after the pandemic and all that good stuff. But all of that is to come back to say that the money area of our economy looks to be pretty strong and healthy right now. I don't see more bank failures on the horizon. And that's a pretty good note. The bank failures that we had were the ones that were most egregiously reaching for the highest rates during the pandemic and just before. And this is something we have said for years. If you're looking around across same products and one of them is significantly cheaper or offering a significantly better interest rate, there's something wrong, and look at it before you jump in there. The Puerto Rican banks for years had interest rates, FDIC insured, interest rates that were way above the other FDIC rates. And then all the banks in Puerto Rico fell down. When you have to give a higher interest rate, it's because there's other issues going on. I mean, it's true if you're buying a car and you have to pay a higher interest rate, it's probably because there's something wrong with your credit. Same's true with a bank. If they're offering a much higher interest rate than a similar bank, look at it carefully. Make sure that you're well insured. There. Man, we've talked about nothing but the most uninteresting interest stuff for the majority of this hour. And we got to play commercials. Hopefully we got something a little bit more interesting than the number of bank deposits or the short interest on naked shorts in the market, which just sounds a little bit obscene. It sounds like a Me Too movement waiting to happen. But and I think we do. I think we've got some good stuff coming up. But if you would like to join the conversation, we have email addresses waiting. I don't think we've given those out at all this hour.
No, we haven't.
Jeff@tpwc.com and Jake@tpwc.com. That's the personal wealth coach or Tango Papa, Whiskey Charlie. And we'll look at those things and answer them. Unless they're about sports, and then we will look at those things and mumble strange things that you will say, they know nothing about sports, and we will say, we know less than that. But in the meantime, we've got some commercials to play. So again, the email address is in here, jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. On the other side of these commercials, we'll be back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
What do you have to talk to us about? I mean, I got a bunch of stuff, but what do you got?
Well, just my usual stuff about the economy.
Well, let's talk about some big events that took place. How about the Eurozone? It's a big one.
Okay. The Eurozone is experiencing about 7% year-over-year inflation right now. And it is also technically in a recession. It's had two quarters of negative growth.
Wait. Negative growth.
Which is shrinkage.
We call it shrinkage around here, even though economically we should say negative growth or contraction.
It's actually contraction.
We call it shrinkage.
Yeah. And so it's an interesting combination. Since if we go back to just before the pandemic in the last quarter of 2019, and we look at the growth in the two economies, the European Union versus the United States, our economy is now 5.4% bigger than it was just before the pandemic. The Eurozone is 2.2% bigger, and it has had two quarters of slightly negative performance, where we have had positive performance, pretty good positive performance, as a matter of fact, the last two quarters. Yes, they did have an invasion of Ukraine, and they had their fuel cut off. So you got to give them a little bit of credit for something. We also had the price of fuel go up here. There's an interesting parallel, and it's not going to be very popular if you're an adherent to the out of whoever at any given moment doesn't hold the White House. That party is always down on the United States economy because it's terrible because the other guy's in the White House. But the reality is, since that time period, we've had both a Republican administration and a Democratic administration. And what we've seen is the stimulus and everything else we did in the United States appears to have worked a lot better than it worked in European Union, where they didn't have the stimulus and were doing otherwise similar things. They were slower to lower interest rates. They've been slower to raise interest rates than we have. So we have been more activists than they have. And it seems to be working a lot better here. We're not in a recession, and we've had much better growth and much lower inflation. Ours is 4.7% year over year. Theirs is 7. They're in a recession. We're not. We've grown 5.4%. They've grown 2.2. So we're actually doing very, very well comparatively. You had something.
Yeah, I was going to put in a parallel here. So same thing that you're talking about with the Eurozone. They're having much higher inflation than we are. They're having other issues in that area. China, at the same time, is having very, very different but also negative issues. They're at zero inflation and probably into deflation. And that's because, one, they didn't have the stimulus, and two, their lockdown was a lot longer than Europe's or the United States. And in the middle of that, at the same time that our fuel prices went way up, they had the opposite occur in China. Not only were they using less gasoline because of all the lockdowns that were going on, they got a cheap source of gas based on the Ukrainian invasion. They were the only people that were still happy to go and buy oil from Russia. So their price actually fell at the same time as the rest of us saw a massive increase in oil and gas prices. Right in the middle of that, so going back to 2018, this is the peak of the Chinese trade to the United States. This is right as the trade war is kicking off, and our percent of our imports from all countries, about 22%, was coming from China. And since then, we're down to, of all of our imports, about 15.4% is coming from China. And if you look at the size of our economy, and you consider that 7% of our overall imports used to be from China and aren't anymore, if you look at that as a percentage of what they're doing, it's a 33% decrease in our imports from China. And what we're seeing in their economic growth numbers based on satellite imagery and the Western stuff that we can still look at And even on their own information, they're not seeing the kind of runaway growth on their economic reopening. We're seeing a lowering month by month of our imports from China this month from last month, which is kind of a big deal because they just reopened their economy. They're ready to give us all the stuff that we haven't had before. A big chunk of that is stuff that we've been talking about all year and the year before, is that we've been relocating factories. We're moving stuff to Mexico and to Vietnam and to India and away from China. And that is having a direct impact on their economy right now. They made some bad decisions. They're still growing, but their growth rate is stagnating. And just looking ahead at what we know about the factory production, the actual production of a factory, the creation of the factory happening elsewhere and moving away from China, it looks like they're going to go into the negatives in the coming year, which is fascinating for the, you know, the golden child of economic growth of China.
There's a big experiment, and I've talked about this before. There's a major experiment going on in the world, and no scientists set it up. But looking back on it, I think economists will have, they're already having a great deal of fun writing about it. China is running their economy as a centrally controlled economy. One of the biggest areas of their economy are still state-owned facilities. They are not allowing the free enterprise market. They've been quashing the free enterprise market since Chairman Xi took over. They are allowing less and less freedom. And he believes that democracy and free enterprise and free markets is a disaster area waiting to happen, and it already happened, so he's going to do everything he can to stop it. Then Europe is running theirs a little differently. It's very bureaucratically controlled. And then here in the United States, we're just wild and crazy. But we're doing a lot of interesting things with the Federal Reserve. So there's three different systems. Actually, there's more than that. But
those are the three major ones, basically. Yeah.
There's other systems working. Russia has a system. Turkey has a system.
Japan has a system. Japan is
failing.
Right. Japan's not failing, but the other Turkeys and Russias are on the brink. But Japan's got a pretty good system going too. They're just, when compared to the major economic blocks, China is kind of a block. European Union is kind of a block, and the United States is kind of a block. And China's sitting there, or Japan is sitting there in the Pacific as a major power, but not in comparison to these big block of states or countries, or China's still kind of a lot of countries. It's a big block. And you compare those different experiments as they're chugging along, and I don't want to say your punchline for you or your bottom line, which experiment seems to be working the best? That's my
question.
These
experiments are running, and they're going to continue to run. And Chairman Xi and a lot of people still believe that democracy and free enterprise is unreliable. We believe it is. The Europeans are running it a different way. So far, since the pandemic, we're winning. And I think probably we have the strongest system. It looks to me like we're coming out ahead. Of course, only time will tell, and it takes decades for these things to show up. But our system is working very, very well. And again, I say, if you're whoever party you're in, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on, when your guy is not in the White House, you want to badmouth the United States. And that's just the way we do.
That's just people. That's what politics means, people.
But it ain't so. By the way, if you look at the economic policies of Donald Trump's administration and Joe Biden's administration, you would be hard-pressed, without being told whose policy they were, to figure out which one was doing what.
Yeah,
they're very, very similar.
The only way you can really tell the difference, when I'm looking at it, the trade war under Donald Trump was kind of unilateral. It was on a bunch of different things, but it was a very basic, this percentage across the board on everything. And the Biden trade war, it's a different percentage rate on like thousands of different items. But the trade war still exists. Okay, well, what about tax cuts. Well, the tax cuts of the Trump administration still exist, and the Biden administration isn't asking for tax hikes. He isn't saying we must reverse this horrible whatever, which is a normal political platform if you're very different from what you had before. So if we just look at it without regard to date, the only way you can tell the difference in the administrations on the economic side of things is in how detailed the different interest rates are. It's really not that big a difference. But when you look at the slogans and the campaign stuff and the people that are really one side or the other, on the economic front is where a big chunk of that argument is. And we're about out of time for this hour. So if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually give investment advice at the fiduciary level and portfolio management that comes with it to people of relatively high net worth. And our firm's phone number is locally
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that same voicemail on the weekends, real live people during the week, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, where you will see our made-for-radio faces and our wonderful staff. You can read our newsletter there. Sign up for it. It comes out every Friday. You can listen to our radio programs going back lots of years. You can find the podcast wherever you find podcasts. You can contact us through the contact form or through email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach. Thank you very much for listening.